Well, as we begin our study on counterfeit gods here this evening, you can be turning there if you want to. We're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 5 here in just a few minutes. 2 Kings chapter 5. And we're going to talk about the seduction of success. The seduction of success. So, I was thinking about this as I was typing up some notes, and I thought, maybe I'm wrong here, and maybe this isn't as foolish of a question as I think, but does anybody not like success? Like, you're like, I'm opposed to it. I don't like to win. I don't like to be on top, or nobody. Okay, see, I thought that would be the answer, right? So there's the potential for any one of us then, right? If we like success, and success is a good thing, it's a positive thing, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we celebrate success in people's lives, but even though it is a good thing, it's not a very good master, though. When it begins to rule our lives, when it becomes that thing that we desperately pursue, then we become slaves to it, and that's where we fall into trouble. So let me just kind of reiterate what I've said, hopefully all along. Most of the idols that we deal with in our lives are not evil things in and of themselves. We've talked about things like love and money or success. Those are not evil things. It's only when they become so significant in our lives that we become slaves to them, like we give our lives to the pursuit of that, then a good thing becomes an evil thing in our lives. And so it was interesting what Tim Keller said about success early on in the chapter. He said, for some, again, this is for some, success is like a drug that gives a sense of consequence and worth. But the high quickly wears off, and the person needs a repeat dose. I never thought about that, but I suppose it's true for just about anything that we can that we crave in our flesh. It can become like a drug, and it can get those hormones going in our body to where we want more of it, and it becomes like a high, like a drug. And you need more and more of it to satisfy. Of course, we understand that I should put satisfy in air quotes there, because it never really satisfies, does it? Has anybody ever seen the movie Chariots of Fire? Don't let me down. Chariots of Fire. All right, good. Some of you, right? It's a great movie if you've never seen it. They don't blow up cars or anything like that. It's not one of those movies. There's no great chase scene or even a great love story in there. There's just none of that. But it's a great movie based on the life of the Olympic sprinter and more importantly, missionary to China, Eric Little, back in the 20th century. Well, there were actually several other Olympic athletes that were talked about and they were a part of that movie. And one of those Olympic sprinters, he was asked at one point in the movie why he runs. Now, when you ask Eric Little, why he runs, he says, I feel the pleasure of God, when I run. I mean, that's just kind of how he thought about it. But this other guy in the movie, when he was asked why he runs, he said, it's not out of love. He said, I'm more of an addict. And then later, when he was talking about contentment, he said, contentment, I'm 24 and I've never known it. I'm forever in pursuit and I don't even know what it is I'm chasing. I'll raise my eyes, talking about sprinting here, I'll raise my eyes and look down that corridor 4 feet wide with 10 lonely seconds to justify my whole existence. But will I? Anybody want to live that life? I mean, success, sure, you're one of the greatest athletes in the world, and you've won race upon race after race, and then you get to that next race, though, and you've got 10 seconds. I guess he's running the 100 meters, right? 10 seconds to justify your existence? That would be a horrible way for us to live our lives. Maybe we're not Olympic sprinters, but maybe you go to your job, or maybe it's something else in your life, and that is what justifies your existence. Being the best at this, or being known as that. Achievement and success can become that idol in our life. So let me ask a general question. I don't have a specific answer here. I'm going to give a few responses in a moment, but how do you know if success is an idol in your life? Say again. It comes between you and God, okay? It consumes your thoughts, yeah. Okay. And time. Mm-hmm. How else? It's something you think you can't live without. Can you think of anything else? How do you know if success is an idol in your life? If you can't find contentment and joy in anything else, right? And you really never will, right? Well, let me give you a few responses here from the book that I think are spot on. The first sign that success has become an idol in your life is you expect to find security in success. If I achieve this, if I get to this level, then I'll have security. Maybe it's financial security. Maybe it's job security. Maybe I feel like I've achieved something, and all of this striving and worry, and it can all end in my life. Suffering will be gone. Happiness will be here to stay. And once I achieve and have success, then all my troubles will be gone. How many of y'all believe that lie? No. We expect to find security in success. That's the first sign. The second sign is you have a distorted view of yourself, meaning achievements serve as the basis for your worth, right? And that is a real danger, isn't it? If I'm at the top, then I have worth, right? Just like this Olympic sprinter from Chariots of Fire. If I'm at the top, I have worth. If I'm at the top of my job, I have worth. If people like me and they value me and they look up to me, I have worth. But if I end up in the valley, I don't have it any longer. That tells me Christ alone is not what I find my hope, my joy, and my security, and my identity in. It tells me that I've found it in something else, and whatever that something else is an idol. And here it's achievement, right? For some people, it means... And this is where he hit a little bit too close to home for me, especially if you come watch our volleyball season come this January. But you have to win every competition, right? I mean, I'm kind of in it to win it, right? That's always been a struggle of mine, but yet one of those things I'm working on, okay? So there you go, prayer request for me. But also thinking you always have to have or always do have all of the right answers. You can't ever say, well, I'm not real sure. My identity is found in the fact that people think I always have the right answers. Or I always have to win. I get the accolades and all of that from winning. So you have a distorted view of yourself because your achievements are where you get that sense of worth. All right? And then the third sign is this. You cannot maintain your self-confidence in life unless you remain at the top of your chosen field. And of course, that can be destructive. I mean, how many people ultimately make it to the top? No matter what it is you do, how many people make it to the top? And if that's the thing that's going to give you joy and self-confidence, and it's going to give you this identity, then chances are it's going to fail us. And even if you do make it to the top, it's still going to disappoint. It's going to fail, right? That can be utterly destructive. So let's see how this plays out. I appreciate how Tim Keller in the book, with every with every potential idol, he shows us a biblical storyline kind of to that bears out that idol. And I think we'll see it here in 2 Kings chapter 5 in the story of Naaman. I'll eventually read, I think, through verse 16, but little by little we'll take it. All right, so let's look at chapter 5, verse 1, first of all. Here's what it says. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria. Some of y'all may have a different name there, but that's Assyria. He was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord, that is Yahweh, the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Right? Was Naaman a successful man? Yes. Yes. Why do you say that? What do you base that on? He was a great man in high favor. He was commander of the army there in Assyria. Or Assyria, I said. Syria. Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. What else? Was he a good commander? He was a victorious commander. I mean, the guy's winning, right? We like guys who win. He's a winner. He's a mighty man of valor, right? He's great, great courage. He had a lot of things going for him, right? Things are going really well. And I think the pun was intended. Keller said in there, he had everything, but life was literally falling apart. When you think about lepers, you get the pun there, I suppose, right? Life was literally falling apart because he was a leper. So with all of his success and everything that he had achieved in life, there was one thing, right here at the end of verse 1, that consumed him. I can't be satisfied. I can't really be successful. I can't really be everything that I desire to be, because he has this real problem, right? He has no satisfaction. All right, so look at verses 2-6, and we'll continue the story here. It says, "Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, 'Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy.' So Naaman went in and told his lord," I guess the king there, thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, 'Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel.' So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, 'When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy.'" That's a pretty bold letter, isn't it? So what do you notice about Naaman right here? Naaman is a pretty desperate man, right? You've got his servant girl, I guess he kidnapped, and she's a servant or a slave to his wife, and she says, "Hey, I know this guy in Israel. He can heal you," and you know, he's a desperate man. So what do successful people do if there's a way to get this thing, that is the cure, the healing that I need? I have the resources to get this done. Who's going to reject Naaman, right? A man of success, a man of means. And I didn't add up, and it doesn't matter, I didn't add up how much this is in today's money, you know, all the silver and the gold and the clothing. But folks, it's a lot of money, right? It's a lot of money. And it's going to sway a lot of people. It may not sway Elisha, but it would sway a lot of people, right? So he takes a huge treasure, and he takes a letter from the king, and from the king of Syria, and he goes to the king of Israel. Now, this is where it gets a little bit interesting, because he has this letter to the king of Israel, and the king of Syria says, it's so that you may cure him of his leprosy. All right, so notice what he's asking here. And then look at verse 7. It says, when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes, and he said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see, he is seeking a quarrel with me. No man in his right mind sends a letter to another king and says, hey, cure me of my leprosy. He's like, this can't be done, right? Well, who does he think I am, God? He can't possibly do it. So now you've got this problem going on here, right? And what we see here, what we understand is, look, the God of Israel, he's not like other gods. Naaman has a Syrian understanding of God, which is just like the view of gods that the nations all around Israel had, right? You can buy them off, right? You can appease them. If you have enough gold, you have enough treasure, you can appease them. But God is not like other gods. He can't be bought. And so for Naaman, you begin to see his success and his achievements, and particularly financial achievements, they've become idols for him. He thinks because of his rank and because of who he is, he can just go to the very top. I just take a letter, take my treasure, I'm going to go to the king. Go to the king of Israel. You think the king of Israel likes Syria? No. Do you remember just reading about the raid in Israel to steal little girls and stuff? No. There's no love between these two, but Naaman is somebody special. He can do what he wants. Just get a letter from the king and he can go to the very top to get what he wants. I wonder, let's think about this. What are some ways that people use their success to get what they want today, or to try to get what they want? If you have success, you get to live by a different set of rules. Yeah, okay. Commit a crime and end up in court, or probably won't, but if you do, see how that works. Yeah. A different set of rules. Yeah. Yeah. You can afford the best, right? If you end up as a celebrity addict, you get to go to these really cool rehab facilities, right? No halfway houses for you. You can get what you want. Well, what are some other ways that people use their success to get what they want? What about name dropping? You ever hear people name drop? What do we mean by that? Yeah, you hope to get favor from them or from other people because of who you know. You mentioned humble brags. You see that on social media. One of the things, and I mentioned this to Rachel every once in a while, it drives me nuts. And I don't think I do it, probably because I don't post on social media hardly ever. But there are some people that I see, they have to let you know every well-known person they had lunch with, right? Or my good friend who just wrote this book, I'm so proud of him. He's my good friend, though. Why wouldn't I be proud of him, right? Maybe you've met him once, but still. And, you're getting your name out there, and there you go. You're rising and you're rising, and I don't know. It's a frustrating thing, name dropping, right? Or maybe it's not in social media, but if I want to, I'm gonna give you a story, but this is a self-indicting story, so just understand that this was like 20 years ago. Okay, I'm coming out of college, and I know people. All right, I know people. Let me put it this way: I know people who know people. Okay, and so I grew up in the land of chicken, right? The land of Tyson Foods. And as I'm coming out of college, I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm called to ministry, and I'm not sure what to do at this moment. So I'm finishing college. I'm married. I'm dirt poor. I'm eating ramen noodles. I told you that story a couple weeks ago. So making money would be really cool right now, right? So I contacted a couple people that I knew, and all of a sudden I had this job interview as for a supervisor at a chicken production plant in Rogers, Arkansas. And as soon as I walked into the plant manager's office for that interview, he looked at me and he said, "You have a lot of friends." That's name dropping. That's to get what you want. Was that bad? Was that wrong? I did it, and it got me what I wanted, right? It got me the position. 20 years later, maybe I can say, don't do that. Don't do that. But I don't know. That's the way you get things, it seems like. The only way to really get some of those positions. But name dropping, maybe pull strings. Get people to pull strings for you because, don't you know who I am? Don't you know who I am? And people pull strings to get you things. You could spend money like Naaman is trying to do. I need to move, don't I? Naaman's trying to spend money to get what he wants, or like he does, you just go straight to the top. I'm going to bypass. If I walk into the judicial center, I'm like, get out of the way. I'm going to go see the judge executive, right? Don't need to check the secretary. I'm above all that, right? We just bypass all the lower people. We go to the top, right? Because of our success. It's we try to use our success to get what we want. This is what Naaman is trying to do. Now, look at verse 8 there in 2 Kings chapter 5. And I'm going to read through the first little bit of verse 10. Verse 8 says this: "But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel.' So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house." And this is the best part, verse 10. "And Elisha sent a messenger to him." The man has a treasure with him. He comes with his horses and his chariots and his entourage, and Elisha sent a servant to him. Sends a servant to the door, right? You've got a great man at the door, and Elisha doesn't even go. Doesn't even meet him. Doesn't even go to the door. What do you think that did to the pride of Naaman? Yeah, not good things, right? Not good things, all right? Let me finish the story there in verse 10. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was angry and went away saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper." I mean, just a big show, right? I was pretty sure, since it was me, successful Naaman, that they're probably going to call the whole town together, and everybody's going to watch him do this great ceremony, and it's going to be wonderful. Then verse 12, "Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in rage. But his servants came near and said to him, "My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So let me ask you a question. What's Naaman's real problem here? Is it the leprosy? Pride. Why do you say pride? Yeah. Yeah, he's furious. Man's in a rage. He's like, First of all, your rivers aren't as good as our rivers. Second of all, you don't even come out to me. You didn't even wave your hand or your wand or did some kind of magic trick. You didn't, I mean, good grief. It's not what he expected. He expected a big show because he's a big man, right? Somebody impressive, all right? So he wants to do some great thing rather than some humble thing. Go wash in the river. He's thinking he could just, you know, drop those chariots and all the wagons with the gold and stuff and just make a big show. And Elisha would say, ooh, let me wave my hands over this and you'll be healed. And that's not what happens here. Now, he's asked to do a humble thing. And I suppose it's natural for us to not want to do the humble thing. You know, he wanted to do some great thing. It's what our movies tell us to do. Think about it. See if you remember from your childhood. You remember the Wizard of Oz? When Dorothy wants to get back to Kansas and she goes to see the wizard, what does the wizard tell her she needs to do? Go dip herself in the river 7 times? Or what does he tell her she needs to do and then come back and he'll help her? Anybody remember? Ah, there you go. Yeah, bring back the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. Some great thing, right? You'd be a hero. People would be telling stories about you if you do that, and then you get what you want. Think about Lord of the Rings. You want to get rid of evil? You want to get rid of Sauron? What is it you have to do? Some simple deed or some great deed? What do they have to do in the story? Anybody remember? Just destroy the ring, just crush it with a hammer? Oh no, you've got to cross the mountains and the plains and through armies, and you got to get to Mount Doom itself and throw the ring back in there. Side note, I've often wondered, these eagles that show up at the end, why didn't they just fly them straight there? Maybe because the movie would have been like 30 minutes? You have an answer? You're gonna solve my problems. All right, very good. But you see, I mean, in stories, we want to see, all right, to get what you want, do something great and magnificent. Naaman's thinking, all right, this is my time to shine. I'm going to get what I want in the end, but I'm going to shine through this, right? And so instead, this great man of success has to take the word of a servant girl, go to the home of a humble prophet, get rejected at the door, basically, and he's told to humble himself by washing 7 times in the Jordan. Now, why does he get an answer like this? Is Harold? Yeah. Exactly. The Jordan? Yeah. Yeah, not too impressive, right? At least give me a big river where there's potential. I might get swept away in the current when I get in there, but not the Jordan. I mean, some of y'all have been there recently, right? Would you be scared to go dip yourself in the Jordan? You wouldn't want to dip in it to get clean. That may be another story, but yeah, another issue. But right, so he's told to do a humble thing, right? And why is that? And I think what God is trying to communicate to him is, look, you can't control God. You can't come with your treasure and buy God. You can't achieve blessing and salvation from God through your own means, through your own efforts. It just doesn't work that way. God will not be a part of our look what I have done story. He's not impressed. He's like, do you see what Jesus did? Top that and we'll talk, right? He's not impressed with our stories. He's not impressed with our treasures. He's not impressed with how great and the things that we've achieved, right? Success can become an idol. It can become a bitter master in our hearts. And so Tim Keller says there in the book, if we set our hearts on getting to the top, but instead find ourselves on the bottom rung of the ladder, it will usually lead to great cynicism and bitterness. That's where we end up. Unless you make it to the top, and you're not going to be happy there, trust me, but unless you make it to the top and you fail somewhere along the way, it could eat you up. It becomes bitterness and cynicism. He mentions another lady in there, a lady who wrote an article in a magazine, Helen Rubin. She said, "Of all the subjects we obsess about, success is the one we lie about the most." Is she right? Why do you think so? Success is the one we lie about the most. Why would we lie about it? We just want to look good, don't we? Yeah. Michael, you want to say something? Yeah. Yeah, we want success, but we don't want to act like we want it. Yeah, all right, there's a dilemma there. You think of any other reason? Why would we lie about success? Because we're taught from a young age, I suppose, that we're supposed to achieve something, right? Mom always said you can achieve anything you want if you put your mind to it. Well, if I don't achieve that thing that I really want, I guess I failed. And who wants to be a failure, right? Who wants to be a disappointment? You know, hey, did you end up becoming whatever it is that you said you were going to be, you know, when you graduated high school, went off to college? Well, that didn't work out. You know, we'll just have to say, we'll make up some story about why that wasn't really the best thing for me. The Lord convicted me to go in another direction or something like that, right? That just didn't work out. I think it is true. I think it is something that we lie about. And bottom line is, chasing success will keep us from chasing after Christ, because we're going to have to lay down one master or another. We have to lay down one idol or another. So let's see if that happens. Let me finish the story in verses 14 through 16, and I'm almost done. Verse 14. So he went down, this is Naaman, he went down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Maybe you should have dipped in there, Doug. I mean, the flesh of a little child, right? Might have worked, I don't know. He had the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant." But he said, this is Elisha, but he said, "As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Naaman was a successful man who had made success an idol in his life, but God's message of salvation comes to him not from the top, and not through his achievements, and not through his successes. It comes to him from the very bottom, from a servant girl in his home, who sends him to a humble servant of the Lord, a humble prophet of God. And not even the prophet, the servant of the prophet. Do you see the irony in all of this? Why do you think God chose this ironic way of really dealing with Naaman's heart and his idol? Why would he do it this way? To make a point. Yeah. Let me give you my answer here. I think it's found in 1 Corinthians 1, 26 through 29. Here's what the Apostle Paul wrote. "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God." I think that's the answer. God is going to get the glory in this, or it's not going to happen, right? Naaman is going to have to put aside his pride in all of his achievements, in his success, and he's going to have to humble himself, right? In submitting to the word of this humble prophet and go do this humble deed, or he's not going to get what ultimately he desires. And what he discovers is not that this God of Israel is a pretty impressive God. What he realizes finally is that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. And that's really the bottom line, isn't it? That's really what he needed to hear. That's what he needed to know. And when we can finally say that, there is no God in all the world except our God, then we can find our identity and our hope and our achievement, well, not achievement, but our identity and our hope in God. And we don't have to try to find it in success or in any other idol in our lives. Amen? Anybody, a final thought or question or takeaway? Complaint? It's always welcome. I don't know about welcome, they're received. Yeah. Right, right. Yes, we do live in a society here in the West, unlike really anything in human history, and it just feeds idolatry. All the different kinds of idolatry that we've talked about up to this point, it feeds it, and we have to be careful. Now, listen, we talked about this. You can't merely say, well, this is a problem for me, so I'm going to crush this idol. No, no, no. You can't just eliminate it. You have to replace it, right? You can't eliminate it. You can't just cut it out. You can't just amputate it. You have to replace it, right? And it's not a matter of, well, I've got God here, and now I've got this idol. No, no, no. We need God to be that one, that person that we pursue and that we worship. And you're going to have one or the other, right? You just have to replace that idol. And I don't know, probably of all the ones we've talked about so far, that one hit me maybe a little bit more. Not that I don't struggle with the others as well, but yeah. All right, anybody else? All right. Well, thank you for being here this evening. Let me pray for us, and then we will dismiss. Father, we thank you for the privilege of coming together here in the middle of the week and taking the time to pause in all the busyness that we have. I know everyone here has things going on, busyness in their lives. I thank you that they considered studying your word worthy of coming out this evening. And I pray that you would bless them, that you would encourage them, and that you would just build them up in their faith and encourage them in their walk with you. And Father, help us to leave here even more committed to replacing those idols or those potential idols in our lives with a deep and desirous pursuit of you. Father, go with us as we finish out this week. Keep us safe. Father, help us to be faithful to you, and we look forward to coming back together this weekend with the whole of our church family to worship you. We thank you for Jesus. We thank you for loving us. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.